Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, November 21st, 2010. My name is James Marino, and on the call this morning is Michael Portantier and Matthew Murray. Peter is away on assignment. Michael can be found where he writes columns occasionally for NPR, for Broadway Stars. He's got a new book coming out on Sweeney Todd, the movie. And he is also the author of Forbidden Broadway, Behind the Mylar Curtain with Gerard Alessandrini. Hello, Michael.
Hi, James. How are you?
I'm doing well. Also with us is Matthew Murray. Matthew is the chief theater critic for TalkinBroadway.com, also writes for Broadway Stars. Good morning, Matthew.
Hi, James. How are you doing this morning?
I am doing well. As I mentioned, Peter is away on assignment. He is actually in is he at CCM right now? I think he's at Cincinnati. I think
yeah.
So. I think he's teaching a master class or something. He's seeing a student for – he's seeing
– a thing at CCM that he does every year. Let me see if I can find his email.
I'm pretty sure I read it on his column last week. He was going out to see a student production of Evita, I think.
And, oh, really? yep.
And then he's teaching a master class. He's probably as we speak right now because he wanted to be on the call, but he couldn't arrange the logistics of it. Anyway, so let's start off with a show that is opening on Broadway this evening called Elling. Which is going to open at the Ethel Barrymore Theater. And Matthew and I actually got a chance to see it last night. It's funny, I was sitting there with my wife, and I said, hey, look, there's Matthew. And dude, we didn't know we were both there. So, Matthew, shall I start or shall you?
You know, James, you never start because you so rarely see stuff before it opens at the time we talk about it. So I would love it if you would give us the starting gun here.
Okay, I wish I had those 2 hours back in my life.
is this like, what was that show that came out? Oh, Festin.
No, this is not as good as Festin.
Oh.
Well, it just sounds like, I haven't Elling yet, but it sounds like maybe one of those things. You're saying that it sounds like one of those things that didn't translate.
Yeah, I don't even know if it's lost in translation there as much as let's get into the meat of the show. I think the big problem with me was that there was so much talent up on stage that I really enjoyed extensively, despite the material. Dennis O'Hare, I thought that he was great. I thought that Brendan Fraser was not as strong as Dennis, and which is sad because it really needs the two of them to have a good repertoire there. And I don't think that Brendan Fraser upheld his end of the bargain there. And Jennifer Coolidge was who is also best known as Stifler's mom in the American Pie movies. She was very good. I enjoyed her. And Richard Easton in a minor role, as well as Jeremy Shamos, was also they were all very good. I thought Brendan Fraser was actually the weakest link there, but nothing that they could do could overcome this material, which was terribly boring to me and my wife. And I just think that it was a big non-starter, and the second act was a little bit stronger than the first act, but overall it was something that I would recommend people pass on. So Matthew, what'd you think of it?
James, I think that you explained it very well. I agree with almost everything you said, except I would actually say that I thought Dennis O'Hare was about as weak as Brendan Fraser. You didn't talk about the plot very much, so we should probably get into it slightly. And it's that Dennis O'Hare, who plays Elling, the title character, and Brendan Fraser, who plays Kel Bjarne. There are a lot of Norwegian names here. The original source was a Norwegian series of novels. They were in a mental institution, and they were released, and the Norwegian government is paying for them to live in an apartment in Oslo and just sort of get back into the swing of life that they've been out of for a long time. And personally, you would think that because this is based on a famous movie from 2001 that was nominated for an Oscar, and the books themselves are very famous, you would think that there would be heart and soul and actual comedy in this show, and there just isn't. It's a series of I don't even want to say sketches, because that's not fair to a show like Saturday Night Live. It's just scenarios that keep unfolding. Like Brendan Fraser builds Dennis O'Hare a house made out of matchsticks, and they go to a restaurant and he meets someone in the men's room. It's a very weird combination of things. There's not exactly a plot, except can these people sort of get back to life? And the answer is, well, maybe not. It's very weird. It doesn't go anywhere. Their writing is okay. I thought the performances, though, were really just not good from the two leads. Dennis O'Hare is playing Dennis O'Hare, a character he's played in many other productions, and it's probably right for this, but I keep wanting to see him do something else and to see him stretch himself. And I wanted the same thing from Brendan Fraser, who is an actor I've liked on screen a lot. I don't believe I've ever seen him on stage before, but he plays kind of a Neanderthal character. They make a lot of comments about how the only things he cares about are food and sex. But I don't think that's supposed to be the entirety of his emotional exploration of this guy. And it really is. There's no growth or evolution in terms of how he comes to grips with what he wants from women. One of the romantic plot line is that he meets Jennifer Coolidge's character, who's pregnant, and they kind of get together and, you know, all that. But there's so little substance to any of it, and there's no corroborating detail, really, that it sort of runs around in circles. Jeremy Shamos is very good. He plays their caseworker, basically, and Richard Easton is playing Richard Easton, but very well as the poet that Elling meets and befriends. But my personal favorite was Jennifer Coolidge. She was the only one to me who elevated the material to something else. Now, you can argue, well, should she have made it kind of this raucous sort of American Pie-like kind of comedy thing? I don't know, maybe not. But I laughed at far more she did than I laughed at what the other people were doing that was apparently supposed to be funny. So I would say it's a success. I don't know why Doug Hughes was directing this. I don't know what he did, because this didn't seem to me like it had been directed by anybody. I can't imagine that it's going to be around very long. I think it's going to join the other shows like A Life in the Theater and Labette is not going to last as long as a lot of people are initially saying it will. But it's a chance to see good actors make huge fools of themselves on Broadway, and you don't get to see that every day. So if you really love Dennis O'Hare and you're willing to try to forget his performance in Take Me Out, which was so good about 7 years ago, then I suppose you could try Elling, but I can't recommend it for anyone who cares about seeing an actual good play.
The Jennifer Coolidge character, she plays 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 listed characters here throughout the show, and they're such hit and run characters. They come in for a few minutes and make a big impression and walk out, and then you don't see them again. So she gets a chance to really chew on the scenery and make a big brash choices, and big brash choices are always a lot of fun to see. And it's like, in an acting class, if you do something called five times through the door, where you get to go through a door five times and make five different wild choices and five different characters. She really nailed that. And I thought she was great too, Matthew. I agree with you there.
The thing about Jennifer Coolidge that amazed me so much is I have seen her in a number of movies and stuff. She's always funny, but she's never stood out for me. But she has a scene in this play where really she stands on stage and pours a glass of water, and she gets huge amounts of laughs doing that. And I mean, there's something else going on stage at the same time that is encouraging the laughs, but she really knows how to pour the water to get certain reactions out of the audience and how to – oh boy, bad choice of words given what else is happening on stage, but how to milk it for really the full laugh. And that's a difficult skill. And I really admire her for that. And she has another scene in the second act where she plays this kind of punk poet type thing. It is ridiculously funny in what's like a 30-second, as James said, a drive-by joke. So thank goodness that she's in this, because it was nice to be entertained by something on stage. But James said at the beginning he thought that it was funny that he and I met at the show. Well, there wasn't much other stuff about the show that was funny for me, at least.
I'm trying to think about Dennis O'Hare, who he really reminded me of in the show. And it sort of reminded me, and I'm not sure if you guys would agree with this, that this was, it sort of reminded me of David Sedaris' stand-up act. And I don't know if you guys have ever seen David Sedaris do a stand-up or anything like that, but it and I'm not sure why that is, but I sort of thought to myself that, you know, if this was David Sedaris in this role and this was just, you know, a bunch of vignettes rather than a show, would this be more successful? But that's neither here nor there. They're opening tonight, and as Matthew mentioned, I don't foresee a long run for them. I can't imagine why what they were selling in this show, because they're not selling the show. So I'm thinking that they're thinking Brendan Fraser is going to carry these ticket sales, but I don't know if it will happen or not. But can only hope for the best for them.
James, I once did jury duty with David Sedaris.
Oh my goodness gracious! You know, that's
funny.
How many people can say that?
You know, very. You should write a book on that. I mean, you know, that's just one of the many, many different reasons to live in Manhattan. You know, I did jury duty with JFK Jr.
Oh wow!
Yeah, he was in the jury pool, and then no, he was called for jury duty, and then he got out. I don't know how he got out, and I didn't, but. Anyway, all right. Next on our agenda is our encore series of Bells Are Ringing. Matthew, why don't you start us off there and tell us what you think?
Well, as you listen to this podcast, Bells Are Ringing has already closed at City Center because encore shows only play for a weekend. And in the case of Bells Are Ringing, I think that's probably a good idea. This is a show that is really very much of its time. Not so much just because it concerns a telephone answering service, which I don't even know if they exist anymore, maybe a couple of them, but really back then, without personal answering machines and certainly cell phones and voicemail, how did people get their messages if they didn't have someone to pick them up for them? So that's one strike against it, but a far bigger strike against it is Judy Holliday, who is the original star and who had the show specifically crafted for her by Betty Comden and Adolph Green, who were friends of Judy Holliday and had appeared with them in a very famous review group called The Reviewers. And they made everything in the show completely tailored to her talents, for impressions and her specific comedy sense and all of that. And that has made the show almost impossible for anyone else to do in the same kind of way. Faith Prince did it on Broadway in 2001 in a revival that I saw, and I thought it was just really, really terrible. It's a wonderful score by Julie Stein. It's got songs like The Party's Over and I'm Going Back, and just the songs are far better than you would expect from any kind of a star vehicle like this. But without Judy Holliday, there's barely a show. We were talking about how Elling is just sort of a series of one-off kind of things. Well, Bells Are Ringing isn't much different. There's an overall plot about how she is romancing this guy that she is one of her clients at this answering service. But for the most part, it's just a chance to see Judy Holliday do a Marlon Brando impersonation or do this joke or that joke or sing Rin Tin Tin 20 times in a row, you know, stuff like that. And when you have someone in that role who's not only Judy Holliday, but who isn't a really trained comedian, it's tough to watch. And I thought, personally, Kelly O'Hara was very tough to watch. I love Kelly O'Hara. I've seen her be brilliant in so many other shows, many of which, to be fair, required more of a legit soprano voice than a belt voice. But she's not this kind of comedian. She can't sell everything that Judy Holliday could sell, and you need someone that can really do that. I don't know who you would get for that kind of thing today. A couple of people were suggesting Leslie Kritzer, who is certainly very funny. But someone who's young enough to pass as a single woman in, you know, the mid-50s Manhattan. I don't know who you get for that kind of thing today. It's really tough. Maybe there's not anybody. But the rest of the production was great. Will Chase was wonderful as Jeff Moss, who's the writer. He sang superbly. It's really a nice reminder of how good Will Chase can be. Judy Kaye played the owner of the answering service. It's very nice. She didn't have much to do. Dylan Baker was very funny as the inspector who's going after Kelly O'Hara's character because he thinks she's running some sort of a prostitution or phone sex ring or something. And David Pitou, who's always great, plays the European bookie who takes over the answering service for his own purposes. And Bobby Cannavale and Brad Oscar, and they don't really sing very much, but again, they're really strong comic actors who know how to handle their material and provide support for the leading lady. So the only problem with Bells Are Ringing, which was perfectly fine as directed and choreographed by Kathleen Marshall, and I have to say this because we've criticized him before. David Ives did, I thought, a very solid reduction of the script. He didn't cut out a ton of stuff. He left a lot of the plot points intact and just sort of trimmed away some of the fat, which is what you should do. You can't hack and slash it into unrecognizability, as often happens at Encores. So really, the only problem with it was Kelly O'Hara. And I've never thought of her as a problem in any show she's been in, but it was really trouble here. I could go on at length about everything she did that was wrong. I don't want to do that. But I just want to point out two things. First of all, I've never thought of Is It a Crime as a difficult song, but the night I saw it, Thursday night, I honestly thought Kelly O'Hara wasn't going to be able to get through it. She was trying to belt it, and she doesn't know how. She's not really a belter. And that song was very painful to listen to. The person that I went with was literally in convulsions at how bad it was, and he normally just sort of sits there and doesn't react. That was really shocking to me. And the other thing was in I'm Going Back, which is the big 11 o'clock number that she sings, totally dead. Nothing going on there. And I really believe that if Kathleen Marshall had not ordered the lighting designer to flash the lights around the proscenium to force applause out of the audience, that the audience wouldn't have cared. It was really disappointing to me. I love Kelly O'Hara. I think she's been wonderful in so many shows, and I'm sure she'll be wonderful in many more. But Bells Are Ringing just did not work for me at all.
All right, Michael, what'd you think?
Wow. I'm going to really strongly disagree on two points. I mean, although it's absolutely true that the show was tailored very specifically for Judy Holliday by Comden and Green, who had worked with her years earlier in The Reviewers, a nightclub act in the Village, I do think that it really does hold up just as a show. I think Comden and Green were too good to write something that would just be a vehicle, if, you know, for somebody to show off. And while there are, you know, certainly specific points where that does happen with Ella putting on these voices to pretend she's different characters and stuff like that, I think there's something very poignant and hilarious about the whole story of this woman who's trying to be everything to everyone. And she's so helpful and supportive to people, but she's uncomfortable being herself until really the end of the show. And then there's also this very non-dated thing about how technology can get in the way of relationships. And, I interviewed Kelly and Will Chase, and they were saying that yes, it's true that nowadays you can in like 5 seconds you can go on Google or Facebook and find out quite a lot about someone, including what they look like. But you know, it is still possible to circumvent that. In fact, we mentioned, I didn't see it, but there's a movie out now called, I think it's called Fish or something like that, about some guy who started a relationship with a woman online, and then she turned out to be absolutely nothing like she pretended that she was. I don't know what the actual outcome is because I didn't see it, but apparently it's a whopper. So I think it is a wonderful show and very poignant and funny, and it does hold up. And I am going to almost completely disagree about Kelly O'Hara. I thought she was fantastic. It is true that she is not a natural comedian in the way of maybe, let's say, a Kristen Chenoweth or a Leslie Kritzer. But she achieved it to me through hard work. And she does obviously seem to have that as an element of her personality, even though we haven't seen it in the past. I thought she was great with the voices and the impressions and just amazing chemistry with Will. And certainly the night I saw it, which was last night, I'm Going Back was quite well received by the audience, and I didn't feel she was struggling. I did feel she was pushing a little bit, but it wasn't anything like a train wreck remotely. I do also think that the only thing I would say is that her when she sings in her soprano register, which is so beautiful, it didn't seem to be quite all of a piece with the rest of the characterization. She did a wonderful kind of Brooklyn accent that I thought was terrific. But that's the only mildly negative thing I would say. And she to me is just she continues to prove herself to be one of the most versatile talents around. I remember when she did My Fair Lady at the Philharmonic, I thought, well, gosh, you know, that's a departure. I mean, how is her Cockney and her proper British accent going to be? And she was great at that, and I think she's great in Bells. And everything else Matthew said, I totally agree with. Will Chase was amazing. Bobby Cannavale and Brad Oscar were fantastic in very small parts. Bobby Cannavale plays the actor, this Brando-esque actor who Ella helps get a break. And Brad Oscar was so wonderfully endearing and hilarious as this dentist who yearns to be a composer. In fact, when when they finally do a number of his in this musical review at the end of the show, there's all this great choreography going on. But the friend that I went with and I said we couldn't keep our eyes off Brad because he, as the dentist, was sitting there just like so incredibly overjoyed that they were doing his song, and it just showed in his whole face and body, and it was a really amazing moment in musical theater. So I'm very glad that although Bells Are Ringing seemed an odd choice maybe for encores, I'm really glad they did it, and I'm so glad that I saw it.
Yeah, Michael, I think that obviously it makes a big difference if something like Encore's which performance you see, because I saw it Thursday night and you said you saw it last night, and
yeah.
Kelly O'Hara, that was her third show since I saw it. So that obviously makes a big difference. And again, I want to stress, I really like Kelly O'Hara. I think she's an amazing talent. But I think that people need to write more shows for her and stop trying to shoehorn her into other shows. I think that she has a very unique set of gifts that aren't necessarily going to be taken advantage of properly in every old school musical. So someone needs to find a way to make the most of everything that she has, and that means writing shows for her. So hopefully someone who's listening either is working on one or knows someone who is and can convince them to speed it up, because she's good enough that – and I think her star is rising enough now that she is ready for that next step, and I hope she gets it.
Well, I will admit that when I heard the casting, I thought, gee, that sounds very strange, but I just thought that she must have worked very hard, and I thought she really pulled it off wonderfully, even though if not the absolute perfect piece of casting that one might think of. I think she should be very proud of her achievement, and I certainly agree that people should write shows for her. Wouldn't that be wonderful?
I just want to go on the record to say that Kelly O'Hara is perfect in everything. All right. So. All righty. So the next thing that we have on our agenda here is the Devil Boys from Beyond, which eluded my radar screen, so I don't know anything about it. So, Michael, why don't you tell me a little bit about this?
Well, it was fantastic, a terrifically campy throwback to sort of a combination of the best of Charles Ludlam and Charles Bush, even though neither one of those people was involved with it. This crazy story about these hunky aliens who come to Earth and people think they're going to wreak havoc, but they're actually here for good. And it had a great gay sensibility, as you might imagine. But it also was I think general audiences would find it hilarious. And Everett Quinton was in it, who was Charles Ludlam's partner and worked with him for many years was in it, and he just kicked it up another notch to be this really incredibly funny event that everyone should see. If you loved Charles Ludlam's stuff, and if you love Charles Bush's stuff, you really want to go see this show at New World Stages. I highly, highly recommend it, and I hope it has a long run.
Well, Michael, I hate to tell you this, but since we started recording the podcast, I actually got an email from the Best of Off-Broadway, which is saying that apparently it's closing on November 28th, which I find inconceivable because it got terrific reviews, and I think it really deserved them. It's really a horrendously funny show. It's one of those things you go to see and say, well, what can they possibly do with this? And they can do a lot. and it's very like Charles Bush, and it's a lot like The Divine Sister, which is still playing off Broadway, except it deals with a different kind of movie. Michael was talking about Charles Bush and Charles Ludlam, and that's correct, but Ed Wood is really sort of the inspiration here, because it really is one of those Z-level 1950s science fiction movies that they make fun of, and the portrayals are just absolutely wonderful. Michael was talking about Everett Quinton, who of course is very funny, but for me the star of the show is really a Paul Pecorino, who plays the female news reporter who goes down to Lizard Lick, Florida, to find out what's happening with this UFO and all that. I thought he's great as this sort of hard-bitten Rosalind Russell kind of newspaper reporter type who has this ridiculous romance with her photographer and all of that. And then there's a love triangle with someone else, with this gossip columnist who broke up her marriage to her photographer, Gregory Graham, who's played by Robert Berliner. And they're all very funny. It really – you can probably complain that there's not the ideal balance between the kind of soap opera stuff that's happening between the characters and the overall science fiction aspect of the story. But it's so funny, it doesn't matter. It all comes together. And the most interesting – I shouldn't say that. One of the really interesting parts about it for me is that I saw it at the Fringe Festival last year in 2009, and I swear I didn't see a single thing that was different about this production. It is the entire same cast. The set and the costumes looked identical. I found a photo from the Fringe production. It looks like one of the chairs might have been a different color back then. I don't know. But this is really one of the rare cases where a Fringe show is already either so far along in terms of its production or is already so polished that moving it to Off-Broadway can't do anything to it except bring it to the people who might not be able to get in during, you know, August and early September if it moves on to the Encore series, which this one did. So I would definitely agree with Michael that if you're into gay humor, if you like send-ups of 1950s movies, this one is really terrific, and it's very well done. It's amazingly funny, and I am sad that it's closing so early, but it's, you know, one of those things you got to take advantage while you can. So if you don't want The Divine Sister to be the only kind of mainstream a show like this off Broadway, I get to Devil Boys from Beyond it in the World Stages right now.
All right. So breaking cutting edge news here on the podcast, which we generally don't get to do. But so let's talk a little bit about the news that has happened the last couple of weeks. We've been so inundated with Broadway openings that we've ignored the news. And one of the things that happened this week that we found out is that John Simon, a much revered reviewer, has lost his position at Bloomberg News. Matthew, why don't you tell us a little bit about John and this story?
Well, I unfortunately don't know John Simon very well. I only met him a couple of times and talked to him, but I've always enjoyed reading him. He's really a powerful writer. He has a very unique way with a turn of phrase, and probably has more quotes associated with his reviews, often for not very nice things that he said, than almost any other critic ever. But I didn't even know about this until I read it in Michael Riedel's column on Friday, that apparently Bloomberg let him go, and they're claiming that he's retiring, and he says, no, I'm not. I want to work. And so, you know, who knows what the truth is. I don't know if it's exactly like what happened in New York Magazine, or if it's something else altogether. But I think it's really a tremendous loss. Say what you will about John Simon's personality and what he says, he has a depth of knowledge and a command of having seen these plays that really no one else currently reviewing has. And I think that's a tremendous loss. He's been seeing theater in New York for 60 some years, and as a result, I remember that he's in his review of The Pajama Game from 2006. He was comparing it to the original production, which he saw. I don't know if he reviewed it, but he's been doing that a lot, and that kind of thing is really invaluable to people like me who weren't even around, or whose parents weren't even together at the time of the original production. And so I feel like that's really a huge loss, and I have nothing whatsoever against Jeremy Gerard or Manuela Holterhoff, who I guess are replacing him sort of in a joint reviewership now at Bloomberg. I have nothing against them, but I don't think that together they're going to be able to replace what we lose with John Simon. And I'm not going to make any excuses for his personality or the way he said it, with some of the things he said or the attitudes that he expressed in his reviews over the years that a lot of people didn't like. A lot of that I don't personally agree with either, and I don't really think is appropriate for putting in reviews in the first place. But in terms of his knowledge and his grasp and his experience, this is an enormous loss to the theater, and I certainly hope that we will see him writing again somewhere else very soon.
Michael, do you have anything to say about John Simon?
Well, I guess I would just say I certainly agree about his knowledge of theater and his writing ability. I think that he was incredibly talented as an actual writer, but there were some pretty outrageous things that he said, and his homophobia it was kind of pathological, at least as he expressed it in certain cases. And to me, that's a little beyond the pale for a critic. So I have mixed feelings about him being fired or whatever it is that actually happened. There are other people with his breadth of knowledge, I think, and maybe who don't have that baggage, that really kind of serious baggage along with it. So that's my feeling about it.
I'm sort of split in the middle between Michael and Matthew. In a lot of cases, I do appreciate the depth of knowledge that he has brought to us, but I also feel as though that there's a lot of mean-spiritedness in his writing, and that's just how I read it. And it's just been so negative, the stuff that he's put out, and he's become more and more diminished as we've become a more and more online society. He had lots of power when we were when the Broadway community was very based in print reviews, and that was really important. But it's sort of like I totally forgot that he was at Bloomberg until every now and then he popped out something outrageous that just ired the community. And I'm happy to see him into retirement. I have to say that. So, I'm saying, let's rather than some major outlet picking up John Simon, why doesn't some major outlet pick up Matthew Murray? That's what I'm saying. That's my campaign, and I'm sticking to it.
Yeah, we'll see about that, James. I'm not holding out a lot of hope, but you never know.
Well, you know. All righty. The next thing that we're going to talk about here is we didn't mention it, but the news is pretty a week old. Harvey Fierstein is replacing Douglas Hodge in La Cage, and I guess that will keep the show open for a little while because Harvey's got a lot of fans, and I for one would like to go see this. So, Michael, what do you think about this?
Wow. Do either of you have this experience where you your general feelings about an artist can sort of turn drastically from positive to negative or vice versa over the years. Because that has happened to me with Firestein, I'm sorry to say. I think Torch Song Trilogy is a really great achievement, and some other things that he's done, but lately it just kind of seems like he doesn't think he has any limitations at all and is trying to do everything and is taking credit also for things that he didn't necessarily do. When he did A Catered Affair, there was a general agreement that for whatever reason that the musical did not work. The property was not musicalized well. I think there was very few people, as I recall, who felt otherwise and felt that it did work. But Harvey, after it was over, made really kind of bitter statements about how people just didn't get it. And to me, I thought, well, you know, if that many people didn't get it, maybe that should tell you something. Then what happened? Fiddler on the Roof, I think was a qualified success. I actually thought he was superior in the role to Alfred Molina, but I know that not everyone had that opinion. I recently read the notes that Harvey wrote for the CD of the revival of La Cage, and I have to say, he writes as if about the property as if it was created from whole cloth. He doesn't make any acknowledgement that the characters and the plot existed previously in a really far superior film. And I thought that was not very charitable of him to not give credit where it was due on that. And now we have the announcement of that he's going to play Albin in La Cage, even though I believe by his own admission he can barely sing at all. Now he is smart enough to have made statements like, he's been saying things like "Pray for me," and he's been giving full credit to George Hearn and Douglas Hodge and people who played the role before. But I think that while he certainly has certain qualities that would make him wonderful in the role, that he just cannot sing it in a way that's going to be acceptable. And I know we're not supposed to prejudge people, but I think that's a little different because we're just talking about actual physical ability to do something. So I'm very wary. I really am. I'll keep an open mind, but if I do get to see it again, but I don't know, a little scared.
Michael, what you say about a flipping opinion on a performer, I have that feeling about Nathan Lane. And it goes back and forth between he can do no wrong to what was he thinking. And so I can appreciate what you're saying there. And, you know, insofar as prejudging, I don't think it's really prejudging. If the Yankees were to announce that I was the new second baseman, I think that most people can say without seeing me at second base that I would probably not be very good at that. Although I would really love to do that in case anybody from the Yankees is listening. So,
and it does happen in the other way. For a long time, I wasn't such a fan of Bernadette Peters, but then I realized it was largely because it wasn't her fault. I saw her in, I guess the first thing I saw her in, believe it or not, not the first thing. I mean, I saw her in Into the Woods, and she was great in that. But then I saw her in The Goodbye Girl, which was just not a great musical at all. And I thought she might have been good in Annie Get Your Gun, but I didn't not think that she was, and that might have been largely because of poor direction. And then the night I happened to see her in Gypsy, she really was obviously ill, so she didn't make a very much of a good impression in that. But I just think she's absolutely amazing and a little night music. And that was so good that it just kind of made me look at everything again and say, well, you know, she really is pretty fantastic. And of course there are all her cast recordings, Mac and Mabel and Dames at Sea and all of those. So it is funny though, how you can sort of, your opinion can morph on someone. And I think you just have to look at the large picture when you figure out, when you're deciding how you feel about somebody as a performer.
Matthew, how do you feel about Harvey?
Well, I pretty much agree with Michael on this. We're just regarding Catered Affair very quickly. One thing I want to say about that is, just about all of the significant changes between the Catered Affair movie and the stage play were the result of Harvey Fierstein screwing with the book, adding in the gay uncle and taking out certain scenes that explained the depth of the emotions in the story. So I will never accept everyone else being to blame for that except him, because I think he was probably the primary mover and shaker on that. But regarding La Cage aux Folles, I have a big problem with roles that are written for actual singers being filled with non-singers. I think it's one thing if you have a show like Hairspray, in which I thought Harvey Fierstein was absolutely fantastic, that is tailored to his specific gifts and abilities and limitations, which all performers have. And a role like Albán, which was originated by George Hearn, and to say that, I mean, the difference between George Hearn and Harvey Fierstein on the singing scale is like the difference between Sarah Palin and Barack Obama. I mean, the difference between oil and water and a salad dressing, okay? That's how far apart they are. They are nothing alike in the vocal department, and I have serious qualms about what the songs are going to sound like. I don't remember what Michael thought about this, actually. Maybe he can tell me. But my opinion of Douglas Hodge is that even he is miscast because he does not sing well enough. When the cast recording for the revival came out, I remember complaining on the podcast that he sounds like he's crooning the entire thing, which is wrong to begin with because it's not a crooner kind of role. But in the theater, it's not that I thought he wasn't going to get through the songs, but I didn't understand why he was singing them in the first place, because his voice sounded like it might have had a little tiny bit of training, but that he was being told, as I believe the people at A Little Night Music are being told, to act the songs rather than sing them. And I think that what you have to do on Broadway, and what I'm assuming George Hearn did, I didn't see it, I admit, but I've seen George Hearn do other things, and he generally seems to be on the ball. So I think that you can have a great singer who can also act the part. And I don't think that Harvey Fierstein is going to pull out some voice that's even going to be considered at the Douglas Hodge level of adequacy. I think that songs like I think that I Am What I Am is going to be very, very hard for the audience to listen to. It's written with very long lines and very meticulous phrases and a lot of sustained notes that sounded fantastic when George Hearn sang them, judging by the available evidence, the Tony Awards and the cast recording and so on. But Douglas Hodge could barely sell it as a diegetic musical number, which it is. And if he couldn't do it, I don't see how Harvey Fierstein could do it. I would love to be proven wrong here. I would love for Harvey Fierstein's acting to really carry past the song, but you still have the voice. With Fiddler on the Roof, did not have a lot of that complex singing. Hairspray, again, was written with Harvey Fierstein in mind. It doesn't sit on long notes for multiple measures.
And he only has like 1.5 songs.
Exactly. Yeah, and yeah. Albán is a huge musical presence in La Cage aux Folles. He leads a couple of songs, and he's supposed to be a major nightclub star. He's not supposed to be just this guy who walked in off the street and is singing the songs. I think it's going to be really tough. I want to make it clear, I'm not complaining about Harvey Fierstein's acting. I think he's actually a good actor, and I enjoy watching him act. But on these songs where he has to actually sing, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't see how it can work. Again, I really want to be proven wrong about that, but it's really a dangerous road to me. And I don't actually see what good it's going to do the show other than people just coming in saying, well, can Harvey do it? Can Harvey do it? We have to know. Let's buy tickets. So I wish him the best of luck, but I don't think I should have to wish luck to anyone who's going into a major singing musical on Broadway. I think that they need to find star quality people who can actually give the role everything it needs. And I don't think that's Harvey Fierstein. But again, I'm going to go see him, I'm sure. And I certainly hope that he can pull it out, but I'm very doubtful. Very doubtful.
He has obviously a very distinctive voice. I'm pretty sure I've read that he has said that his voice was damaged earlier in his career. I don't know if it was nodes or something like that, but that's what it sounds like. So, you know, you can't have a major handicap like that and be asked to sing this kind of music. I'm really kind of wary. But yes, Matthew, I should say I thought he was absolutely perfect in Hairspray, which was tailored to him. And I do think he should have done the movie instead of John Travolta.
Yeah, so I tend to agree with you guys about his singing, and but from a I wonder from a producerial standpoint why they chose Harvey in a city full of highly qualified and box office draw men that could do that.
Can I float a theory, James? This is just an idea here. I have no idea if it's accurate. I think for whatever reason, rightly or wrongly, that the musical version of La Cage aux Folles is seen as kind of a stratification of the story. And so maybe they think that by getting Harvey in there, they're going to attract a gay audience to what is a very straight treatment of the story. Maybe. I have no idea.
Well, then also, you know, the newsworthy aspect of the fact that he wrote
the book and now he's doing the show.
Yeah.
But you know, those are two very different things. One is a very, I guess they're both from a marketing standpoint, but from an artistic standpoint, why would you put Harvey into this role unless Harvey demanded to be in this role?
Well, you know, maybe he did. You know, I don't know what demanded means. Obviously, they don't have to agree to it.
Have to agree to it.
Well, I mean,
When you're a Broadway producer and you option a Broadway show, the writers have casting approval, which is unlike Hollywood.
Well, but they could have closed it.
Yeah, they could have closed it, but, you know, why not keep it running for a few extra weeks with Harvey to get some money into it? And
but James, there's the potential for extreme embarrassment.
Absolutely.
What if the reviews are horrendous and the bottom just falls out of the box office, which I mean, I don't believe the show is doing all that incredibly well anyway. I wonder if he's considered that this could be a major embarrassment.
Yeah. So
my feeling is that the producers were probably looking at Fiddler on the Roof as the bellwether for this, thinking that if Harvey Fierstein was able to keep it open for as long as he was, that he would be able to do that with this too. And I mean, it's at last week it was at 70% capacity and brought in over $500,000. So they must have faith that he would be able to boost it up enough.
So let me say something along the add to what Matthew's just brought up. So what if Harvey does it for 12 weeks on Broadway, then it launches a national tour starring Harvey?
What if? I don't know.
Yeah. I wonder if that would be a selling point for La Cage on the Road, is Harvey.
I've always been, you know, it's so hard to
sometimes. Well, Harvey recently did a tour of Fiddler on the Roof as well.
And
so,
they could repeat those cities that Fiddler went to, and you only need to keep it open for a couple of weeks in each city, which Harvey can certainly carry a couple of weeks just on his name alone in each one.
But it's sometimes, isn't it very hard for me anyway to sometimes get an exact fix on exactly how much of a name, you know, someone is in terms of selling tickets, because there are always so many other variables. I mean, maybe people would have gone to see Fiddler no matter who was in it, you know,
yes.
or maybe not. And, you know, maybe people would have gone to see Hairspray. It's not always easy to, you know, sometimes it's easy if, you know, if a big movie star comes to Broadway in some old play that, you know, that somebody pulled out of a drawer and it's a big hit. I think we can pretty much say that it's the movie star that's the draw, like as in the,
so if Hugh Jackman went into La Cage, you'd think it would sell well?
Yes.
I totally agree with you, Michael, that it is really, really hard to quantify the value of a name, and you know, in live theater, it's impossible to have a control group to match A against B to see if it works or not.
Right.
And I think that if anybody has that formula, they, you know, they'd be calling us from their yacht in the Bahamas, you know, because that's an incredible unknown of what you're mentioning, but it's true. Absolutely. And I'm just supposing. I don't know anything. I don't know if Harvey's going to go out on a national tour. I don't know any of this stuff. But, you know, I'm looking at the top line producers, and it's Fran and Barry, and I can imagine that this is going to go out. And if it does go out, if it went out with its Broadway star, then I think it would have a bigger selling point on the road rather than just another production of La Cage coming in with some very good actors who people don't really know. But if it goes to the same houses that Harvey played Fiddler and they marketed that as such, it makes it a little bit easier to pre-sell the show. And I think from a business standpoint that putting Harvey into the production was a business move and not an artistic move.
Well, one thing I'll say is, I mean, whatever happens, I hope that he does start to give credit to the creators of the original film. Because
that's a very good point. Absolutely.
It's just not. I mean, if you read these notes in the CD, I think you'd be pretty shocked. It's really as if he wrote the whole thing from whole cloth, and that's not true.
All righty. So we're turning to this week's segment on Spider-Man, as we do every week. As Matthew so succinctly put together in here in our pre-show notes, the injuries and general ridiculousness of Spider-Man. And so we have a few subtopics, the injuries, and then there's the partnering with Sci-Fi Channel, and then there's the lead producer is in a lawsuit with his former employer. So Matthew, do you want to tackle any of these?
Well, I'll just give, you know, a couple of brief impressions about it. I think that whatever happens with Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark when it finally begins performances late next month now, I think that it will have given us all so much enjoyment just from the pre-show news stories that have now been going on for over a year that it will rank as just one of the most entertaining musicals in history, even if it's a complete and utter travesty. But I mean, the big thing right now has to do with all the injuries. I believe that two different people have been injured, and just this past week, the flying sequences, there are apparently a bunch, like two dozen or maybe even closer to three dozen, that were being inspected by the safety inspectors who were going to say, well, you're not going to be able to do the show if this is happening. And I believe that happened on Thursday or Wednesday, and I haven't actually heard the outcome of that yet. But really, the safety thing is kind of one of the biggest news stories right now. But one thing that I thought was particularly interesting, and James, I know you always like talking about business kind of stories, is that Spider-Man is apparently partnering with Sci-Fi, the former, Sci-Fi Channel, which for their marketing, and I think it's really kind of an interesting idea that they're going after that particular audience, because maybe it's just me. I consider myself a little bit of a sci-fi kind of geek, and I don't know how much of a crossover there is in their audiences besides me, and maybe not very much. So I think that it's really interesting that they're branching out so much and going after a type of clientele that's probably younger and less inclined to go to the theater in general, would be my guess. Now, what I don't know is, can this group of people who are likely to watch the Sci-Fi Channel, can they afford tickets to see Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark on Broadway when they're going to be extremely expensive? That I have no idea. That seems to me like it's probably the biggest stumbling block. But I think it's I think it's really a fascinating idea. And something else, this is just to digress a little bit, but the musical by the South Park creators, The Book of Mormon, which is coming to Broadway in the spring, that is selling tickets at the southparkstudios.com website, which is the where you can watch every episode of South Park ever, except for the ones with Muhammad in them. I think that it's the same kind of thing. Are the South Park people likely to go see the Book of Mormon because Matt Stone and Trey Parker wrote it? That I actually find a little bit easier to believe. Again, the South Park strikes me as going after a younger audience, and I don't know how much money they would have, but the Book of Mormon is going to be spiritually more similar to South Park than I would say Spider-Man is going to be to the traditional sci-fi offerings. So I don't know, but I really will be fascinated to see what happens with this and whether these gambles going after non-traditional audiences pay off. I think that if they do, it could really inspire or I would like to hope that it would inspire producers to go after specific groups. MTV did it with Legally Blonde. They knew their audience. They knew what they were going for, and they did that too. So I wonder if this is going to become more common in the years ahead.
Well, Michael, were you going to say something?
Well, you know, what's so fascinating to me about Spider-Man is I wonder, and maybe, I don't know, maybe James, you can address this. I wonder, they must have crunched the numbers, as it were, but it's fascinating to wonder how long it would have to run on Broadway, at what capacity to pay back its initial investment, let alone make a profit, and also how you know, other productions will factor into that. I'm assuming, you know, that they are hoping and planning that it would play in places like Vegas, where they might actually have a far greater profit margin, I think, because maybe the union rules are different there. But, you know, I mean, I believe it took The Lion King quite a while to pay back, as phenomenal a success as that was. So do you think these people are saying, like, well, we don't really expect to have it pay back for 10 years?
Nobody has seemed to be able to make the numbers work.
It's not even as if, you know, there's not a film sale in the
this is what my point is with sci-fi. Sci-fi is owned by NBC, and NBC's main competitor is ABC and CBS, and we all know that ABC is owned by Disney. And so this is lining up as a sort of a channel distribution war between Disney and the producers of Spider-Man. You know, they talk about how What does this partnership between Spider-Man and sci-fi really mean? Well, it means that there's going to be some commercials and creatives and marketing done on sci-fi for no money being exchanged. Well, sci-fi wouldn't do that unless there was some benefit on their side. So perhaps there is some sort of exploitation of the material on the back end. And I don't know what that would be.
Well, I don't know what it would be either, because it sounds like the kind of thing that you would not want to experience on TV or in a film, even if that was made available. It sounds like it's an arena show that is all about the incredible stunts and visuals, and that it has to be seen live. So it's not as if, you know.
Well, I mean, Spider-Man, maybe it's not Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark, but Spider-Man, the property itself. Maybe there's going to be some sort of television series or animated thing that's on sci-fi as well that would work in conjunction, where the Broadway show and possibly worldwide shows and touring productions would in essence advertise the sci-fi brand that was coming out in the future. And all this is speculation. It doesn't make much sense right now in the few facts that we have, but you have to we have to take a leap here because obviously sci-fi is in business to make money and create value for their shareholders and NBC. And to do this for no money for Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark, which is, you know, a freight train running down a mountain run right now. We don't know when it's going to get to the bottom. There's got to be some upside for them. It just, from a business standpoint, doesn't make any sense unless we make these leaps that something is going to happen on the sci-fi end that would pay off for this.
Yeah, I mean, but why? Because I also don't know how it plays out in terms of the rights. You know, I mean, obviously there's a whole series of Spider-Man films that have nothing to do with this. So what actual rights are owned here, and how would they exploit those specific rights as opposed to the rights that, you know, that there are for, and isn't there, by the way, isn't there a reboot of the movies about to happen?
I believe so. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but that, I don't think that has anything to do with this, does it?
I don't think so, but, as I said, you know, I was unfortunate the choice of freight train going down a mountain in retrospect. But I, you know, maybe that's more accurate than we think. But the above the title producers for Spider-Man include Hello Entertainment and Sony Pictures and Marvel Entertainment. So Marvel, in my guessing, owns the Spider-Man brand. And if they've got something else going on, obviously with Sony Pictures and with, you know, sci-fi NBC or whatever in the future, this would make more sense. It's like when we talked about Disney doesn't really publish granular numbers, so we can't really figure out what Disney's investment into Broadway has been in picking up a theater and moving it down the block a couple hundred yards, and all the money that was put into Lion King, and nobody ever knew those actual numbers. So we don't actually know if Lion King operates at a loss and it's just as a big advertisement for Disney, or if it's actually a self-sustaining business. And again, it's really hard to measure from Disney's standpoint what the value of that as an advertisement would be, but it's a great advertisement for Disney. It's right in the middle of Times Square with a beautiful, huge theater and a seemingly successful show from that supporting of a movie. So, is Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark, is this going to be in support of other media projects, or is this going to be a project that actually makes money? And we so often hear stories about stories that are out of Hollywood about, you know, the Forrest Gump that never made money because of the way in which accounting rules are implemented. And so, you know, these are just all theories, and I'm sure, as Matthew has mentioned before, once the curtain actually rises on this, we haven't talked about the plot at all. You know, we haven't talked about, is this great music with Bono and Edge, and is this a great book, and did Julie Taymor do great direct? We're talking about things that are happening outside the four walls of that theater. So I'm looking forward to it. It's just right around the corner. Literally. I'm looking at IBDB, is November 28th the actual preview start?
I believe that's the latest, and then opening in January.
In January.
Yeah, I actually thought it started previews next month, but maybe I...
Well, next month is only a couple days away. November 28th, it starts previews, so it's just a couple days short of December 1st.
Wait, that's a week from today.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe we should delay the podcast. We should go to the first preview and then do a podcast right from the auditorium.
James, you want to do that.
Along with the rest of the population.
Well, I understand that lots of folks, since they did push back the previews and openings, and folks that had purchased tickets ahead of time were able to get a refund on the tickets, but when they went to purchase replacement tickets, in essence, do an exchange of these tickets for new tickets, they couldn't use their discount codes, and there seemed to be lots of disgruntled folks who really embraced it early, and the producers have pissed off those people right away, which is not a good way to start building your base of fanatical fans that are going to go out and tell everybody this is the best thing ever. And So we'll see what happens there.
By the way, has anyone read, have they stated what the seating capacity of the theater is in its new configuration?
43,000.
No, I mean, I would be curious to see. Because
no,
as I
Michael,
said,
that's a good question because it was about 1,800 before, I think, right?
Right. I mean, I wonder if it's a lot more.
No.
Do you think?
Well, I don't see how it could be more.
Well, because I believe that, you know, the entire theater has been reconfigured as an arena. So,
well, no, they. I spoke to somebody who really said it's just a thrust off of the proscenium. It's not really arena. It's not. There's no.
Really?
Yeah. Oh. There's just a thrust off the proscenium. It's like a kind of like a rock concert. You know, where you're not going to have seating behind the stage or around, and it's not going to be in the middle, like Circle in the Square or something like that. It's just a, think a U2 concert or a Broadway Bears or something like that, you know?
Oh, I was envisioning it completely different.
Yeah. I think if anything, they've lost some seats. But I think that they've taken out some seats, but I don't think they've added, any seats. As far as I can tell, but they've jacked up prices. You see, you look at some prices out there, and you think that these are scalpers, and it's actually not scalpers. These are the producer prices that they are selling at for some VIP selections. So, which is, you know, when it was the Ford Center, there was VIPs, and when it was the Hilton, there was VIPs, and now it's the Foxwood, and there's VIPs. So, you get an extra drink and a special coat room for your coats and things like that. But we'll see what happens. All right. Enough of Spider-Man this week. We'll certainly return to it next week. The last thing we want to talk about for this week's podcast is the Tony Awards announced that they're going to be at the Beacon Theater. And I want to say that I think we had discussed this as a well why don't they use the beacon. I think we talked about this back when we thought it was going to be up on 181st Street or so.
I think you're right.
I couldn't find the podcast. You know, I've been on a side note, excuse me, if anybody out there wants to help Broadway Radio this week on Broadway Out, we were talking to a bunch of different services that do transcriptions of podcasts so that we can, you know, get these things down on a searchable format. And the transcription services were just really, really out of our budget league. So if anybody is interested in transcribing podcasts, you know, drop us an email and let us know. And because it would help us to do some searching. I tried to do some searching on the we talked about the Beacon Theater and the Tony Awards, and I couldn't find it. It was taking too long, and I couldn't get to it. But all right, so the Tony Awards at the Beacon Theater, Matthew, Michael, why don't you start us off? What do you think about the Beacon Theater for the Tony Awards?
Well, I haven't been there since the renovation. I hear it's beautiful. I'd love to see it. So that's very exciting. One of the reasons I asked about the Foxwoods is that I was thinking that if that had vastly increased its seating capacity, that might have been a future venue for the Tonys, but maybe not. So yeah, this sounds great. I had also thought that the New York State Theater, now the Koch Theater at Lincoln Center, might have been an option, but the Beacon, I hear, is just gorgeous. And so I do hear though that they, and this might be a good thing, that it is very limited in terms of wings. And so they may have to severely minimize the what they do in terms of production values, especially sets. So that might actually be a good thing, and maybe putting, you know, more focus on the performers rather than you know, all the glitz and stuff. So we'll see.
Matthew, what do you think?
I have very mixed feelings about this. I think that the Beacon Theater is a lot better than whatever that one we were talking about up at 181st Street. Yeah.
The United Palace. The United Palace.
Oh, is that it? Yeah, I don't even know. Yeah. But I think that and I like that it's going to be on Broadway. I mean, literally on Broadway. I think that's really a positive thing. But the reason that Michael Riedel keeps giving for why they're doing this is what I find so odious. And that's, well, you know, they need a stage big enough for these shows that have 40 producers so they can all get up on stage. I think that's a horrifically bad reason for.
Well, I think he's just poking fun at the producers. And
well,
and,
okay.
And I really don't think that that's
not,
played into
that's
it.
Not true.
I think I certainly hope not, because I think that, you know, that if there's any truth to that whatsoever, that it's really horrible. But I guess personally, you know, I would like it if the Tonys would go back to Broadway, because a lot of these shows were a lot of the shows just sort of look better in smaller spaces. I think that a number of shows, when they do their musical numbers, which is a big opportunity to sell it to the world, I think a lot of them just don't come across as well as they might, because they're written and staged for presentation on a much smaller stage. And when you toss in that with the added problem of it being on television, I think that a lot of times you don't see the shows at their absolute best. And I don't know if that's going to be a problem with the Beacon Theater. I've only seen one show there, and it was post redesign, and that was Banana Spiel, and you know, that was its own kind of kettle of fish. So I actually don't know, in terms of stage space and wing space, what the Beacon Theater offers. But yes, it's an absolutely beautiful theater. It's owned by the same people that own the Radio City Music Hall, so obviously it's got that kind of whole it has that going for it as well. So I don't know. I think it's better than some choices they could make, but I would love to see the Tonys go back to actually being in Broadway theaters. I don't know if that'll happen, but I think it'd be nice.
Yeah. You know, again, we talk about the trade-offs there.
Well, I wonder how much they, you know, I mean, I guess every little bit helps, but I wonder how much they actually make in terms of ticket sales to the general public, because obviously that's another consideration. You know, weighed against how much additionally they pay for a place like Radio City.
Most people don't realize that nearly every single person that walks into Radio City Music Hall has paid for their ticket one way or the other. I think nominees are comped, but that's it, really.
I believe that, I'm not sure, you know, I wish I could remember, or something like the nominees are comp, but they have to pay for their guest.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah.
No, and so you and these are not cheap tickets. I mean, they're starting at $200 and going up to $600-$700 a seat, and you're talking about a couple thousand seats in Radio City, so it's considered in the millions. And that helps defray the cost of putting on the actual show itself, and the the infrastructure. But I don't think it's a huge moneymaker for the league and the wing. I think that it's kind of a break-even scenario for them. And so that'll be a little bit different for everybody. Yeah, bringing it to the Beacon, but bringing it to a Broadway house. You know, certainly we're taking out a couple, a thousand or so seats at least in the largest, you know, the Gershwin to the Radio City. I think you can fit 2.5 Gershwins into the Radio City. So that's a tough one. And plus, everybody wants to go. And so who do you cut off and where and when? And it's usually the people that get cut out are the people who aren't economically able to go to see this, and should that be what Broadway's about, is, you know, cutting out those things. So
but obviously for years and years it was there was no, I guess, virtually or absolutely no general public at the Tonys at all, because they just didn't have enough room. So that, and then that change, and I guess it's
no, I'm saying, you know, even if you talk about folks who are not paid well that are working on Broadway, like a dresser or somebody like that,
who's part
of a show,
yeah,
and has got to, you know, fork out, you know, $400 or $500 for a ticket plus whatever they're going to wear and the things for that, and it's an expensive prospect for somebody who, ironically, is working at the top of the business and not making a good salary, is typically the folks who are working on the production are not paid very well. Press reps are not paid well, and people that work in the general manager's offices are not paid well. And, you know, I mean, the actors are paid a living wage. If they're not stars, they the equity minimums for a Broadway show are in the thousands per week. So they're making good money, but certainly, you know, hair, makeup, dressers, costume, wardrobe, general management people, press people, that they are really scraping to get by in, you know, $40,000 to $50,000 a year jobs, and living in New York, which is very tough economically. So to leave people out that are financially unable to, and this is their industry, and they have a show that's possibly winning, to cut them out is sad. And I hope that doesn't come to pass.
But you're right, James. People have always, assumed that. I mean, I've run into major supporting stars of shows who, were going to watch the Tonys at some friend's house because they just couldn't afford to buy the ticket,
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Everything in life is a trade-off. If you're going to spend the $500 there, or you're not going to spend $500. And I've seen people who have just, out of principle said, I'd rather, take $1,000 and give it to Broadway Cares and I'll go to the parties afterwards rather than to spend $1,000 just to be sitting in the thing. Ken Davenport last year, threw a big party, and certainly he could have gone to the Tonys and paid for whatever. And he threw a big party, and it cost him a lot of money out of his own pocket, probably more than going to the Tony Awards. But he had a big party in the Upper West Side and invited lots of folks from the Broadway space and various other fans from the industry. And they had a big old party and watched it on a big screen TV. And it was great. So there's lots of other ways to do this. And but going to the Beacon at least keeps it on Broadway, as Matthew mentioned, and even if it is in the Upper West Side. And hopefully we'll get back to Radio City next year. All right. Anything else you guys want to add before we wrap up?
Just to tag on to that, my understanding is that the arrangement with Cirque du Soleil is for multiple years. And because I know someone who works at Radio City, and that the Tonys, it doesn't look like they will be back there anytime soon.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. Yeah. Breaking news here on Broadway Radio. Breaking news. Alert. Michael, before we wrap up, at the top of the show, you had mentioned you wanted to say something, and I've forgotten what it was because I didn't write it down.
Oh, yeah. I saw what I guess was the last big tribute concert to Stephen Sondheim in his birthday year, 80th birthday year, at Carnegie Hall on Friday night. And it had some really amazing moments in it. Aaron Lazar, Alexander Gemignani, Christian Noll, Kate Baldwin were the soloist guests, and Marilyn May, who has had an amazing career resurgence lately, did an "I'm Still Here" that just brought the house down. It was unbelievable. Aaron did a rendition of "Being Alive," which is the greatest I've ever heard. Especially,
it has to be one of the best sung in history.
Yeah. Were you there, Matthew?
No. I wasn't there, but I've heard him sing other things. And notwithstanding what he was asked to do in A Little Night Music, he's just a ridiculously good singer.
And and to hear those orchestrations, the original Jonathan Tunick orchestrations, with that huge orchestra playing on stage, as a friend of mine said, to have them on stage on top of everything, it brings out the clarity of the individual orchestral parts, and it was an unbelievable experience. The New York Philharmonic had actually scheduled a full concert version of Company with the original orchestrations a few years ago, and then that was scuttled when the revival came to Broadway, the last revival. So I hope that they revisit that idea and do it, because those orchestrations for that original Company are just unbelievably fantastic. Jonathan Tunick is a genius, and it's while I loved the revival with Raul Esparza, the John Doyle revival, obviously it was not the same thing to have 12 people playing instruments on stage while performing as to have a full orchestra playing those beautiful orchestrations. So that's something that I hope happens at the Philharmonic at some point in the future.
All right. Thank you, Michael. sorry that I missed that. Yeah. It sounded like it was wonderful. Yeah. So I want to wrap up here. I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these podcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayStars.com, and on the right-hand side, there's a Broadway Radio logo. If you want to subscribe, right below the logo, there is a button that says subscribe, and that way each and every time a new episode of our podcast comes out, it'll be automatically downloaded to iTunes. You can also subscribe in the Zune Marketplace and also listen to us through Stitcher Radio, S-T-I-T-C-H-E-R Radio, which is an application you can download on your iPhone, your Android device, your BlackBerry, and various other phones. And also you can listen to us on Broadway World Radio 3 times a week. If you'd like to contact us, right above the Broadway Radio logo on the right-hand side is a contact form on the front page of BroadwayStars.com. If you'd like to send us some feedback or tell us we were wrong about something or just help us out a little bit or say hello, you can do that there, or you can pick up a phone and call us at 646-873-7695 and leave us a voicemail. And if you leave us a voicemail, we may play it on the podcast. So on behalf of Matthew Murray and Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, who is out at CCM right now, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radios this week on Broadway. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody. Somebody